Hey, it's Glenn Thrush with this week's Off Message podcast here at Politico. If you were a kid growing up in New York in the 1980s, it was the meanest, nastiest, most every man for himself decade in the history of the city. The two names you couldn't avoid, even if you wanted to, were Donald Trump and the Reverend Al Sharpton. We're still working on Trump, but we were fortunate enough to get 45 minutes last week with the Reverend Al in his office at NBC, and we did an awful lot of talking about Trump, who the Reverend knows really well. Despite his disgust with what he said were Trump's racist and xenophobic statements, the Reverend Al can't quite get past some positive feelings he has for him, kindred spirit feelings. Kind of views him as a fellow outer borough interloper in the big city and in the country. And he offered what I think is probably the best and most clear-eyed assessment of Trump's motivations I've heard anywhere. And he also issued a challenge to Bernie Sanders, who is very much courting his endorsement right now, as is Hillary Clinton, telling me that Sanders should come on this podcast to talk about growing up in my Brooklyn neighborhood. Sharpton grew up in a very different part of the borough, and he thinks Brooklyn is the most racist part of the most racist northern city in the country. We're working on the Sanders campaign also, so stay tuned on that one. Before we get to the Rev, a little bit of business. Subscribe to us on iTunes and rate us. We've already gotten a lot of feedback on my Obama podcast and the bus ride we took with Jeb Bush last week. And by the way, you can always email me your comments, suggestions for questions, suggestions for subjects for the podcast at gthrush@politico.com. And we're going to have an episode every Monday morning. During busy times like next week with the South Carolina primary, we are very likely to post multiple episodes. So stay tuned. Without any further ado, here's Al Sharpton. So, good afternoon, Reverend. How you doing?
I'm good.
Let's talk about Brooklyn. Let's talk about Bernie Sanders and Madison High School. Now, you went to Tilden, right?
That's right.
Tilden isn't there anymore.
Tilden's not there. The building's there. It's not there. But I graduated Tilden in 72 and went there for 4 years, right, in Flatbush. I used to take the bus from Brownsville, East Flatbush, right. Really, Lenox Road, East 96,
I know
out
it.
To Tilden.
Wow. And the were you a pretty good student?
I was average, but I was very active then. That was the years I started getting involved in activism.
Ocean Hill Brownsville.
Brownsville started in my freshman year. I couldn't go to high school for the first month or two because of the strike with Albert Shanker and the UFT. I remember.
And Wright was, what was his name?
Sam Wright. Was the assemblyman.
For those people who are out there who are scratching their heads wondering what the hell we are talking about, we're talking about the really famous UFT strike, the teacher's strike that really changed the whole politics of the city.
Right. It was around community control.
African-American
community control of the schools in that district, and the teachers struck. And we didn't go to school for like 5 or 6 weeks.
What'd you do?
Nothing. I mean, I was very much church involved. I had just joined Operation Breadbasket, Dr. King's organization, yep. And I was youth director, and I would go over Reverend Jones Church and do breadbasket stuff all day.
Now, you and I have another thing in common, which is you went to Brooklyn College for 2 years.
Right.
I went there for... 5, my friend.
Is that right?
Yes, I was.
So I dropped out, and you stayed.
I stayed.
That's funny.
What'd you do at Brooklyn College? What'd you major?
I was at the downtown campus, School of Contemporary Studies. Then I was at the main campus, Political Science.
Me too. Yeah. We probably had the same professors.
Probably.
You did a little better than I did. So let's talk about Brooklyn. The other connection that I have with Bernie Sanders is all my family went to Madison High School. You know Madison High School. That is a heavily Jewish and Italian neighborhood. And I would dare say, in the 1980s, I did not go to Madison. I went to Sheepshead because there were race riots in Madison.
Yeah, I remember that.
Up and down King's Highway.
I remember that.
Really nasty stuff.
There were race riots in Madison and South Shore.
South Shore.
And then there was the riots around Canarsie High when the first black kids were going to a junior high school 2 blocks down. I went out and was part of those marches. And what a lot of people don't understand is the racial clashes in the North. I wasn't born in the South. I was born in Brooklyn. And it always annoys me when I hear people talk about our march down South that are from New York. But why didn't you march right here? Why didn't you stand up with us in Howard Beach or Bensonhurst or Canarsie? So, the great liberals that go to the South and march, but at home are very silent, have always been very annoying to me.
Okay, now here's where I flip the pivot, right? So, Bernie Sanders grew up in that same neighborhood. And it was as racially segregated back then as it was when I was going there. And he's a guy, and he's a white Northerner, a white Jewish Northerner who went down. He went on the March on Washington, right? He became somewhat activated on civil rights. How do you think, growing up on the other side of that color line in Brooklyn, when you look at a Bernie Sanders who grew up in the neighborhood that I grew up in, what sort of attitudes do you think come with that? And what kind of attitudes does one have to overcome?
The attitudes are that you live in a total segregated world. I mean, people ran out of those neighborhoods, couldn't go to school in those neighborhoods. We, different pockets of Brooklyn and Queens, but Brooklyn's where I grew up. You knew you couldn't go in those neighborhoods, period, end of story.
And what would happen to you if you went in those
neighborhoods? You could be hurt, which Yusuf Hawkins in 89 was killed just getting off the train in Bensonhurst. I led that fight for justice for Yusuf, and those guys went to jail. I was stabbed leading a march there. That's how dangerous those communities were. That's the kind of areas Bernie came out of, which is why I said to him, that's good to the general media, what you did in the South, but what about here? And even if you had moved to Vermont or wherever, did you ever come back? On your way to Alabama or wherever you march, did you ever stop at home and help us out?
So I'm trying to get him on the podcast to talk to him just about this. They keep rescheduling, so I'm going to use this as a platform to request. Wouldn't you like to hear him talk about that
stuff? I'd like to hear him talk. And again, I'm not attacking and saying he didn't, right. But I've not heard him talk about it.
But what did he say when you talked about that?
He says he was always progressive, but we didn't get... I don't remember him getting very specific, so it'd be a very interesting.
I would really love to hear about it.
And again, a lot of because of the Northeastern media doesn't like to talk about racism in the North. They never talk about those chapters.
Well, I can tell
but
you,
it's very important.
There was racism in the house that I grew up in. You know, Jewish folks use a different word than the N word. Right. They use the S word, which I'm sure you've heard before.
What the whole fight with from Ed Koch into Giuliani? I mean, all of that. And I think that was it Jackie Mason got in trouble for
with
using
the fancy,
that word? That's right.
Right, with Dinkins.
About David Dinkins, the first black mayor in New York. Only black mayor we've had in New York.
Bill Lynch, who you're familiar with as well, had played a big role in that. So in terms of the dichotomy in this debate between Hillary and Bernie is super interesting. The whole thing about he's talking about the larger basket of economic justice, and she had spoken more specifically, I think, about the racial component. Is there a real difference between those two candidates on that issue, or do you think it's manufactured?
I think that it's, I won't say manufactured, but I think it's exaggerated. What I was concerned about is dealing with the racial aspect of the economic policies that Sanders was talking, because my argument to Sanders, which he has dealt with now, was that if you close all the big banks and everything is brought down, that still doesn't make us equal, given the race gap in employment, given the race gap in wealth and property ownership. You've got to address race. And with her, clearly, because of a lot of the baggage from the omnibus crime bill and the welfare reform bill, she had to address race. And what my commitment was that I am a civil rights leader. I'm not a party leader. My concern was to have front and center in this the question of racial disparities. And everyone wants to talk about who I'm going to endorse. And like I've been saying, it's what I'm going to endorse. What will determine who, not who will determine what.
Well let's settle on that point. I'm not going to ask you who you're going to endorse. You said you weren't. I'm sure you'll tell me offline and I'll tell the world then.
And you'll tell the whole world.
I'll tell the whole world then. In terms of the what here, from when you're assessing both of these candidates, just at the moment, and I'm not talking about for the purpose of endorsement, who do you want to see moving a little bit further on this stuff?
I want to see both of them move a little further. I want both of them to specifically say, this will be my economic policies, my education policies that will include blacks. Have you noticed that we're dealing with affirmative action, the Fisher case in front of the Supreme Court, but you couldn't tell me which either candidate would do about affirmative action? Have they ran on it? Have they talked about it? And how do you deal with equalizing the playing field without talking about things like affirmative action? And that is a current case. We're not talking about Bakke years ago. We're talking about right now.
And by the way, it polls, the thing about that always blows my mind on affirmative action, it polls surprisingly well, particularly with Democrats.
Right.
It even polls pretty well with independents.
But it has not come up in one debate. and not one speech. He's come up in my meetings with both candidates.
What do they say when you talk to them about it?
Oh, yeah, yeah, we should talk about that. But they have not, and we have not been clear about it. And it comes back full circle when you had the untimely, unfortunate death of Justice Scalia. I was in the courtroom 6 weeks ago when he said, what he said about affirmative actions and maybe black students should go to lesser schools, paraphrasing them, of course, where they can keep up. This is a contemporary issue while you're running. That I want to hear. How are you going to equalize the playing field? And also in education. How are you going to deal with the criminal justice system in terms of mass incarceration? Are you going to continue what Attorney General Holder did in terms of saying that nonviolent criminals should not be facing mandatory sentencing, that you will appoint an attorney general that will tell his assistant U.S. attorneys to not ask for maximum sentences? Will you continue his fight on voting rights? We have a lot of people are calculating this election without keeping in mind that you have 15 states that have new voting laws that are going to affect this year that have never had before. We don't know how that's going to affect people. And we don't know how it's going to slow up people at the poll with ID and other things.
So you'd be a fool to endorse before you dealt with these issues, right? Is that the way you kind of feel about
this? I would be preemptive. Because
you can do it. Come on, you can give me a better word than preemptive.
Well, I would be preemptive. Let's put it that way. I see my job as president of the National Action Network to make sure the agenda's out front and to put people's feet to the fire. Will I endorse sooner or later? Yeah, but
can you give me?
But I'm not ruling out that I might not, because the agenda is more important. Let's go to our hometown for a minute.
Yes,
in New York, when they had the mayor's election. I was one of those leading the crusade against the stop and frisk policies of the last administration under Bloomberg and Ray Kelly. We had a huge march down Fifth Avenue, silent march. Bill de Blasio marched with us. Bill Thompson, who was the only black candidate in the race and who was the city controller, who I was leaning to support, came out of nowhere and said he supported stop and frisk. I publicly announced that I would not support him, tantamount supporting de Blasio and ran around doing stop and frisk rallies with de Blasio. I've always been policy driven. And I think we cannot get to the end of the term of the first black president and then start just turning into party people without saying, well, who's going to continue not only the Affordable Care Act, but what they've done in criminal justice under Holder and yep. then Lynch, what they've done in terms of fighting as they have in the court, they were the ones who fought the affirmative action case. Where is this going? And I think that people don't realize we're getting ready to face the first time in American history a white succeeding a black president. We don't know what that's going to look like.
Well, so in terms of, you know, Hillary Clinton, you talked about sort of welfare reform. A lot of people forget how controversial that was. Marion Wright Edelman and her husband quit the administration over that, right? Didn't have the child care stuff in that thing. So the question is, you know, people talk about trusting Hillary Clinton. You know, trust but verify, right? Do you feel that the assurances that you're getting, let's take each candidate individually, do you think Hillary can be trusted on this, considering what her...
I think that the fact that Hillary has openly talked about some of that was a mistake, and President Clinton. I think the fact that she did do a good job working with President Obama has brought some people to consider or reconsider their trust question. She's going to have to convince people to go all the way. I think what's helping her and Sanders is the outright bias, hysteria that we're hearing from the Republican side. So it's almost like you may not be 1,000% sure about this side, but you know what you're getting on the
but
other side.
But you basically
side.
At this point in time, you feel like you basically trust her personally.
I feel like that I can trust the judgments now of Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. Doesn't mean that I'm going to necessarily endorse. I know you're going around about the same way. But
No.
But I certainly, compared to the other side, I can trust him. Now, let me tell you something. I've known Donald Trump a long time.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
I think Donald Trump is what you see. You know, he calls me names. I think what he has said has been bigoted and bigoted, but I don't know if Donald Trump really is a bigoted guy. He is what he is.
Why do you say that?
I don't call him a bigot.
Right,
he called me and said, "Why are you saying that?" I met with him.
Yeah.
And I said, "With the Bertha stuff, the Mexican stuff is racist."
Right.
You calling me a racist? I never said you're racist. I've gotten out of name calling because that gives people a scapegoat out. But what you're running on, and you're getting endorsements from outright hate groups.
And how did he deal with that personally? Because you've known this guy.
Blah, 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 blah. I mean, if I've said
how
it
are we
before,
transcribe that
I'll
noise.
Say it again. I've said it before. I say it again. The bombast. If the best way I could describe Donald Trump to friends is to say if Don King had been born white, he'd been Donald Trump. Both of them are great self-promoters and great. At just continuing to talk, even if you're not talking back at him.
But so. you want that. But that would necessitate Trump moving that hair up front.
Yeah, well, that's true. But he has a unique hairstyle. I think at the end of the day.
So Trump became. Have you said that to a lot of folks?
What
because it's a brilliant comparison. I mean, they really are.
I said it to
similar.
One other reporter, but it didn't get much traction. So you can use
that is an incredible.
That's who they are, and the reason
and
I say
them,
that
you actually like them both.
Don King introduced me to Donald Trump when Donald Trump got.
Yeah, tell me that story.
When Donald Trump began opening hotels in Atlantic City. He wanted to get, first he had to deal with the fact that much of the city council there was black.
Right.
And that he had to deal with, he wanted to get boxing in. Mike Tyson was a hot sensation.
That's right.
Don King and Tyson was working with me on when I was painting crack houses, closing crack houses. Don King said, you need to make peace with Al Sharpton because I had marched on Trump about the ads he had ran against the Central Park Five, which I ended up being right about.
Wow.
That they were not the guys that raped the Central Park rape victim. And so Donald Trump said, yeah, he's a businessman. So Don King had me fly with him and Trump to Atlantic City in Trump's helicopter. And it was one of the most memorable things in my life to sit on a helicopter, big black Trump helicopter, with Don King and Donald Trump, both of them talking nonstop, not listening to each other. And I'm sitting there. It was probably the longest plane ride. It was a helicopter ride I ever was on.
Well, some people would say it took both of them to shut you up, right?
It took both of them to shut. I haven't been quiet since.
So what were they? Do you remember anything they were talking about?
Remember, it was like nonstop, a full blade. No, I have no idea what they were talking about, but it was self-promoting. And Trump.
But you understood the thing about Trump. So I said this before we started rolling the tape. It's like 1986. It's like the bonfire of the vanities back up again.
Oh,
right?
That's what it is.
Yeah.
And Trump.
I mean, but you know, the fact that look how far you've come, look how far he's come.
It's Trump and I, 30 years later.
Yeah.
And I think that. Very few people have lasted in the public eye for 30 years, particularly in New York. So I understand he's got that kind of personality. There's no question about it. His politics has always been right wing.
Right.
But he's also the kind of guy that adjusts and tries to deal with whatever he has to deal with, as he says, to make a deal. There's no doubt in my mind if he wins the nomination that Trump will move to the center.
Has he given you and you have talked, was that the only time you've talked to
That's
him?
That's the only time I've talked to him since he started.
Did he give you any kind of winks and nudges on that stuff?
Oh, no, he never winks and nudges. You just know him. And he's called me names on Fox and all of that. But Donald Trump knows deep down in his heart that I believe in what I'm doing. And I know that he believes in what he's doing. He believes in Donald Trump.
Do you, I mean, that's his deepest principle.
That's his
Do you like
very
him,
deep principle.
Just generally?
I mean, I don't like what he's doing,
right.
But I don't dislike him. He's the kind of personality that is hard to dis. He's entertaining, let's put it that way.
But you understand him in a way that very few people could.
You'd have to be a New Yorker to understand
Well,
Donald Trump.
Yeah.
You'd have to be a New Yorker. And Donald Trump reminds me of a lot of New York guys that owns businesses that do what they have to do to survive. And I think New Yorkers understand Trump.
Do you think when you see him up there and he's changing, you don't think he necessarily believes any of this stuff that he talks? Do you think like he has anything particularly personally against Mexicans?
I think that he has some hardcore right wing beliefs, but I think a lot of what he verbalizes is totally just him shooting for the vote and giving glib lines. I don't think a lot of that's deep seated, but I think his deep seated stuff is right wing. He is by no means a progressive. I don't think he's a phony in that regard.
Did you just one more question about him? Did you guys, was there ever a period of time back in the 90s where you guys actually socialized together, hung out?
No, but he's come twice to National Action Network conventions. That's why when he talks about Sharpton's car, he came to National Action Network's dinner one year. He came one year when we did the ribbon cutting.
Why? What did he say? What was his justification?
It's a big New York event. And he wanted James Brown to perform in Atlantic City, and we were honoring James Brown. He came. And I have photos of him and James Brown and I at my dinner in 2006. Donald Trump has come. Now, I don't remember if he paid for his ticket or not, but he probably told me it was in the mail. That's Donald. But
he's got a rep for that?
Well, with me. I've never remember asking him or receiving any funds for National Action Network, but he has come to our event.
One other thing, like you have talked a lot. You start off with Mahalia Jackson, right? And then you're obviously around Reverend Jackson, and James Brown was a big influence on your early style, right? And you're an orator, and you're somebody who studies a crowd and really appreciates this stuff. When you see him speak, what I'm looking at, I'm thinking, and tell me if this wasn't your observation, I'm seeing a guy who it looks like he hung out with comedians. Like, his rap seems like a very, like, Jackie Mason, almost Mort Saul weird kind of.
Yeah, I learned, I started as a boy preacher, as you said, went on the road with Mahalia Jackson. So I learned from Pentecostal and Baptist preachers how to preach. I learned activism from Reverend Jackson and then Reverend Bill Jones. So I'm a guy that knows you study people to form your style, and then you innovate and becomes your own style. He had to study these comedians in New York because
his, I mean, am I right? Do you pick up on that too?
That's his total debate performance.
Yeah, okay.
And his speaking performance.
Right.
He's not an orator. He doesn't get up and make a speech. He doesn't inspire. He doesn't. He's not erudite where he informs.
Like Obama.
It's all thick. It's all like a Jackie Mason kind of thing. It went rolls off wisecrack, rolls off attack wisecrack. It's all which you see in comedy clubs around New York.
Right.
He's had to pick up that stage. He's good at it. But I can't imagine him making a presidential address. Can you imagine an inaugural address? Where was he going to do? Insult every world leader? Use them as his targets? I mean, he's the most non-orator that I've seen as a major candidate.
But it's amazing.
But he's glib,
right?
And he's effective.
And he can.
But he uses a total non-presidential style.
But he can also read a room. And like that's the thing that I found really. I've been to a couple of them. If you get a chance, by the way, I think you would get. I mean, I don't know how you would get in there. But like, if you had a chance to see him live, you'd see something, I think, pretty extraordinary.
What I think is, I think growing up, and you got to remember, and I think a lot of people that view this or read the articles, Donald Trump was a Queens guy.
Right.
Father was a successful real estate guy, but they were Queens guys. They were out of borough. That had to break in the big Manhattan
you got it.
Aristocracy.
That's such a good insight.
He was an outsider. Rich, but outsider. He was not part of the Manhattan elite.
So he's always feeling.
So he always had this outsider feeling.
That's a great.
And he always was us against them. So in many ways, when I read people talk about, well, how do you have a billionaire as a populist? He does feel like he was one of the guys that was shut out.
Sounds like somebody who I know pretty well sitting right here.
On the other side of the coin. But I was shut out because of race. He was shut out because of geography and a number of other things. The other thing is he learned how to read the room to cut his deals to get where he got. And he's reading bigger rooms now. But he learned the art of really trying to focus on who am I going to sit in front of to be able to get to my deal? And I've had to learn that, too.
Because that's been the nature. So you both came up in a very unforgiving environment, right?
Unforgiving environment and a city that could easily swallow you up. Easily.
At a time when it was probably, I'd say, the 80s to me. It was the 70s people talk about. The 80s was a mean.
No, the 80s. The '80s in New York was as mean as anything in the '60s anyway.
People don't know.
And people don't know that. I mean, I was stabbed, jailed many times marching. It was a very ugly time that we dealt with. I mean, talking about outright racial murders.
There's just blood. People were getting killed routinely. People in the city
We didn't have videos then.
People don't realize now what 2,200 murders means. A cousin of mine was a because the Jewish folks, I don't know if you know this, were the housing cops.
Right.
So there was something in the, what is it? What was the precinct in Brownsville East, New York? 77, 79, one of those.
77.
There was some killing, maybe the pink houses, I'm thinking, where the body was a crack killing, and the body was half in the gutter and half on the sidewalk. And if it was more on the sidewalk, it was the housing authority, the housing cops that had to deal with it. If it was in the sidewalk, the NYPD had to deal with it. So what happened was the housing cop, who I was related to, nudged it with his foot so that more of the body would be in the street so that the NYPD would take it.
Wow.
I mean, that was the kind of stuff that would happen, you know?
Literally. I mean, yeah. And that's the climate he and I both grew up in.
Shifting gears for a second, I wrote a story last year about your influence with the Obama administration on Ferguson and how you had become an advisor. Are you, over the course of Obama's administration, particularly his first term, African-American leaders expressed a lot of disappointment. A lot of the CBC folks felt he was dodging issues having to do with race. Tell me about your relationship with him, and do you think he's closing strong, or do you think there are areas where he himself could get a little
I think he's closing very strong. I think the fact that he has been anything but a lame duck president. I think the fact that he has initiated some things like what he's done in the criminal justice area, like what he's opened up in terms of what he's doing with My Brother's Keepers. Like yesterday, we had the meeting with intergenerational civil rights leaders, John Lewis and C.T. Vivian, the generation ahead of me and Mark Morial. And then we brought all of our youth leaders. Mine is 18-year-old young lady from Atlanta. Morial brought his. He had activists from Baltimore. I think he's trying to set a tone. And he's very committed. Barack Obama, who I got to know when he was running in 07, Barack Obama is much more of a man with a backbone and convictions than people think. He's quiet and deliberate.
Than before?
But he's very firm. I think it's coming out more.
Do you think it was always there, or do you think it's come over time?
I think it was always there. I just think that he's very strategic. He knew when he wanted to unravel or bring public what, because he was trying to get things done.
But you don't think it has anything to do with this, the anger of having been, in his mind, attacked? Like, look at the Mitch McConnell thing with the not considering the Supreme Court justice. That really got him deeply angry.
I think that he's the kind of guy, though, that knows how to use his anger to fuel his strategy rather than his strategy coming from his anger. And I think that he also is strategic enough to say these guys have fumbled in public, so therefore it gives me more wedge room to go through. If they had done it in private, he would have may have been angry, but he would have had to calculate different. They've played into places where they've given him the upper hand, and he's been smart enough to coolly go through. He's a brilliant political mind and a brilliant intellect.
Did it bother you at all? Sanders, in an interview a couple of days ago, said something to the effect that Hillary was just hugging the president to get African-American voters. You think that was a little bit over the line? She got very upset about that.
Who?
Sanders said that in some interview that Hillary was hugging Obama really hard just to get African-American votes.
I think that a lot of people resented that. I think that the fact is that Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, who had a heated campaign, they got together and they went through some very serious stuff, including bin Laden and all, when she was Secretary of State. Right. And I think that you can't use certain terminologies without people saying, oh, wait a minute now, they were working together through some tight stuff. And people resented that. Plus, it's unnecessary to say stuff like that. Run on your platform. Run on what's going on. You can never interpret somebody else's relationships.
Do you think Sanders gets race?
I think Sanders has a good background. But coming from New York, again, I want to know where at home you can show me your sensitivity to the race in New York, where I know was a cesspool for bigotry, particularly in the years. You got to remember, Bernie's like a half generation to generation older than me.
That's right.
And so it was even worse.
Oh, yeah.
When he was coming up. It was even worse. And I think that is what would tell, that conversation would tell me what he's really knows and is comfortable with about race.
Do you feel she's good on race?
I think she's familiar with it. She worked for Marion Wright Edelman as he marched with Dr. King. And I think that her husband and his Arkansas background and living more with blacks, they were more cultured. But comfort and culture is two different things.
Do you talk with Bill Clinton much?
No, from time to time.
Do you enjoy those?
Never been hangout buddies. Fascinating guy. I mean, he's the guy that it is absolutely true makes everybody feel like you're the only one in the world. And he's real good. He can zoom right in and you feel special. I remember when he was president, I disagreed with him during the Louima case. Yep. I went down there and I brought Mrs. Diallo down there doing Amadou Diallo. And I went to protest, and in meeting with him, you'd almost have to keep reminding yourself you're mad at him. I mean, he's good.
Which of these folks, and I'll just take a couple more minutes here, which of these folks do you talk with most frequently? Do you talk with Hillary pretty frequently, offline?
I don't talk to either one of them frequently. I don't try to build personal relationships. I have a very small circle.
That's interesting.
You got to remember, I work Nash Action Network in the morning, come do a radio show 3 hours a day nationally.
But you'd also get co-opted, right? I mean, you don't want to.
I kind of keep my distance because right. I've seen people get swayed by having too close a relationship.
Last thing I want to talk to you about, you're talking about generational stuff. This is something I've heard you talk pretty passionately about. We were talking about some of the stuff going on in South Carolina right now. This younger generation of African American activists, you know, right. The Black Lives Matter folks, give me your general assessment of where you think they're headed, and more specifically, what role are they going to play in 2016?
I think that that first of all, as they say, they are decentralized, leaderless movement. So you'd have to talk about what aspect. A good example is you had one or two that were in the meeting with us with the president, and then you had one invited that denounced the meeting.
Right.
So it's hard if you don't have a coordinated kind of one infrastructure that has principles to judge what the impact's going to be when you have different segments doing different things by design. I think they've done a great job in helping move forward a lot of the issues and a lot of the energy. But can it consolidate into a political movement if you have different factions that are decentralized and some that don't advocate voting, advocate the political process, some that does? I also think that there's a whole lot of young activists that are not only in traditional organizations or organizations like National Action Network, but what about young guys like Hakeem Jeffries in Congress now? I think that it's a mistake to say, and Al Sharpton or Mark Murray, I'll speak for all blacks, it's also a mistake to say that all young blacks are monolithic. There are many young blacks that are conservative or middle of the road, that are not as progressive as a lot of the ones even in my organization. In South Carolina, you're dealing with a lot of young people who come out of military families
right.
and go to church every Sunday. If you remember, when we had the tragedy in Charleston
right.
last year, the 9, I went down, I attended 3 of the funerals, spoke at 2 of them with the governor. They didn't want any of the activism, and you didn't see all of that in Charleston.
Right.
Because this is a very conservative state. I'm talking about blacks.
No, right. It's why Obama and Hillary dodged the gay marriage question
that's
in 2008. Correct.
Right? And I think that is what people are giving this universal, like, oh, well, the young activists will affect the young vote, and Sharpton and them may have impact on. It's not that easy. There's a big difference between South Carolina blacks and Florida blacks, and Florida blacks and New York blacks, if you don't understand the nuances. Now, all of us suffer discrimination. All of us suffer double standards. But there is a huge difference in how we respond culturally. And a guy who comes 4 generations military in South Carolina, which is not rare in the black community, thinks much different than guys that grow up here hanging out in Soho.
Isn't it a little ironic sitting in that chair right now, you were always the young guy who was breathing down the necks of the establishment African-American leaders. You were an outcast.
Right.
You know, people wouldn't even sit down and have a meeting with you.
That's
and, you
right.
know, even recently, you know, there was, you know, I won't talk about relationship with Reverend Jackson. That's been litigated. But isn't it a little bit ironic, though, just generationally, that you're, you know, that they're coming up behind you and not necessarily appreciating what you're doing?
And the instruction for me is that I am going to not make the mistakes the guys ahead of me did. I'm going to embrace and work with those. I've spent a lot of times with, that's why I brought Mary Pat Hector to the White House, Kirsten Ford, all of my chapter leaders. We have 102 chapters, biggest probably civil rights convention every year. And all of my chapter leaders tend to be under 40. And that's why I say there's a whole, some of the more revolutionary groups don't agree with me, but that's not age, that's ideology. There were revolutionary groups that didn't like Dr. King or didn't like Reverend Jackson in his height. Right. So I got that. But there's some young folks that I'm nurturing that will take national action. They're going to keep going.
Okay, let's finish up on last two questions. Let's finish up on New York City, because we both love this city.
Yep.
You mentioned Hakeem Jeffries. Do you think, just for the sake of diversity in the primary, do you think it would be a positive thing to have Hakeem Jeffries challenge Bill de Blasio in the primary?
If he felt that there was something to challenge him about. I think that Bill de Blasio ran on, he'd bring down stop and frisk. He did. Crime did not go through the roof as they promised. It would if they ended stop and frisk. He did pre-K. He has challenges in homelessness. I don't know if that's enough to, for Hakeem to challenge him. I think Hakeem has an opportunity with Charlie Rangel retiring to become the voice of the Congress or the New York delegation and has a real promise in Washington. I go to Washington a lot. We have a Washington bureau. He's respected. And I've told Hakeem he ought to really build his star there. Who else do you have on the horizon of that generation?
So you're okay. You've had some disappointments with de Blasio, right?
I mean, I've had some disappointment in terms of I wanted him to concentrate more on homelessness, but I think he's done a great job as mayor.
Do you think he gets? Do you think he gets the job? Do you think he understands?
I think he had a learning curve, as any mayor does. I think the media was against him. I think he came out of nowhere and shocked everybody. But I think he's done well with that learning curve. And I think I disagree with Hakeem on some things. I think he's far more with charter schools than I would be. So I think that we need both of them right where they are.
Wow. On that note, Reverend Al, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you, Glenn.